From Kansas to New Jersey, Louisiana to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States will decide whether or not the president can remove appointees to so-called independent agencies. Hans von Spakovsky is here with details. One-third of the seats in the United States Senate are up for election this year. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The decade of the 2020s is half over, and already the economic missteps are accumulating. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary on why states that cut taxes are growing, while high-tax states are experiencing population loss. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Independent agencies are technically part of the executive branch. Should the president have the power to replace those appointees at will? Hans von Spakovsky is a former senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation who recently joined Advancing American Freedom. He joins us now to discuss the case. Hans, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Hans, there has been a lot of back and forth between the Trump administration and the courts over presidential power, particularly as it relates to so-called independent agencies created by Congress. There's something called Humphrey's Executor. Sounds sort of like a medieval punishment of some sort. But tell us what Humphrey's Executor, what that philosophy or underpinning of the legal system, what does it really do and mean, and why is it important?
The progressives, of which Harold Wilson probably was the first president, pushed this idea that government should be run by so-called experts, right? People who are not amenable to politics. Somehow, you know, the American people just couldn't be trusted. And so they started creating these so-called independent federal agencies. And Congress, with each of these agencies, would put them under the leadership of multi-member commissions and limited the power of the president to fire them. Most of these commissioners can only be let go under the law if they've engaged in some kind of wrongdoing. So in essence, presidents have basically no supervisory authority over any of these agencies. And an agency like the Federal Trade Commission, if the commissioners were appointed by a prior president, can do everything they can to thwart the elected president. In 1935, of all people, Franklin Delano Roosevelt actually tried to fire one of these new commissioners on the Federal Trade Commission, and the Supreme Court ruled he couldn't do it. That commissioner had been actually appointed by the prior president, Herbert Hoover, and the Supreme Court said it was okay for Congress to limit the power of the president over these agencies. That's been the law for 100 years. No president's ever really challenged that until Donald Trump. And when he came into office, he started firing the heads of many of these agencies. The case that's up before the Supreme Court involves Rebecca Slaughter, who was a commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission, ironically enough, appointed by Joe Biden. He fired her. She sued, saying, "You can't fire me." And that's the case up before the Supreme Court.
Taking a look at this from a broader perspective, Hans, the ability of the president to enact his or maybe someday her policies really depends on the regulatory powers of these various so-called independent agencies. So I assume the Trump administration is arguing that this is central to executive power and that perhaps Congress has delegated too much power outside the executive branch?
So the Trump administration has argued, and by the way, the case was argued at the end of last year, so the court's already heard oral arguments about it, is that, look, the Constitution, Article 2, makes the president the head of the executive branch. And yet these independent agencies are doing what? They're carrying out executive branch functions, including, as you well know, I mean, they can sue you, prosecute you civilly, impose debilitating fines on you, ruin you professionally and ruin your business. And the president is saying it's a violation of the Constitution that I don't have supervisory authority over those agencies. Funny thing, Loman, is that during the oral arguments, Justice Brown Jackson actually repeated that very argument the progressives made 100 years ago, saying, oh, we need these independent agencies because we need leaders of the agencies who are not amenable to politics, which basically says that they're not going to be accountable to voters. She actually repeated that and clearly is going to rule against the president.
As we look then at the oral arguments that occurred, a lot of the other justices who are frequently referred to as conservative justices, we can argue that term, but we won't right here, they appeared to be leaning more toward the administration's point of view?
Yes, they did. They were very much questioning the power of Congress to do this. And look, one of the things that everyone pointed out was that that decision in 1935 about the Federal Trade Commission, it really wasn't right at the time because the Supreme Court basically said that, oh, the FTC doesn't really carry out executive branch functions. What it does is quasi-legislative, quasi-judicial. Well, that was wrong in 1935, and it's definitely wrong today. When you look at the power that agencies like the Security Exchange Commission have, or the Federal Election Commission, where I served as a commissioner. I mean, when I was an FEC commissioner, we could go to court, sue you for violating federal laws on campaign finance. That is the essence of what the executive branch does, particularly the Justice Department, which, what do? They enforce our laws.
And enforcing laws is, of course, the responsibility of the executive branch.
That's right.
Headed by the president, of course.
Yes.
This has been sort of an overarching strategy of those on the left since President Trump took office almost a year ago now. Hans, it seems like they've been very active in court in finding judges all around the country who will at least temporarily block the president's initiatives. Should we expect to see that continue as we head through the year? And it looks like the president's had some success in fighting back those efforts.
He has had actually great success winning the majority of these cases in the courts of appeal, and particularly at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has been extremely active on what they call its emergency docket, issuing stays or suspensions of injunctions issued by the lower courts. That happened in the current case, Trump versus Slaughter, in which we had lower courts saying, oh, you know, you can't fire Rebecca Slaughter. And instead, the Supreme Court took up the case. And I think there's a very good chance that they're going to overrule the Humphreys executive decision and say that, yeah, Congress can create these agencies, but they can't limit the power of a president to, for example, fire them, because that's the only way the president could have supervisory authority over what those agencies are doing.
Hans von Spakovsky, thank you for being with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Among the things he does for us is keep an eye on key U.S. Senate races around the country. Scott, we're kicking off a brand new year here, 2026. A third of the U.S. Senate is up for election. Great to have you here with your analysis.
It's my pleasure.
Republicans control the U.S. Senate currently, but not by a lot, correct?
Not by a lot. Just like the House of Representatives, pretty narrow majority. I think we have 53 to 47 in the Senate right now. The Democrats have a couple of so-called independents that have always caucused with them, like socialist Bernie Sanders. But nonetheless, Republicans have pretty much delivered in confirming President Trump's judicial nominations and executive branch nominations and getting the One Big Beautiful Bill done through reconciliation. We know how important this majority is, and I think that we've got a very good chance at maintaining it. But there's a couple of races that are starting to pop up that, depending on the electoral environment, could be competitive races. One of them is in Iowa. And several months ago, we received that announcement that Joni Ernst was retiring from the United States Senate at the end of 2026. President Trump came right out the gate and endorsed Ashley Hinson for the U.S. Senate in that race. And I think that it's just one that we have to be keeping an eye on. Iowa is a state that has had Democrats before. I remember Tom Harkin being a longtime senator from Iowa. And it's also been a state that has sort of bounced back and forth between Republicans and Democrats over the last 25 years. So how is the electoral environment next November, next fall, when early voting starts? I think that's going to largely determine how much attention we need to be paying to a state like Iowa, where we've done very well recently.
Another state that we would typically put almost automatically in the Republican column, neighboring Kansas. What's happening in the Sunflower State?
Well, in Kansas, you've got Senator Roger Marshall that is actually running for re-election. And normally you'd say, oh, he's an incumbent Republican and in a red state. Everything should be fine there. We also have a governor's race in Kansas. And for some reason or another, these friends down in Kansas, they like to elect Democrats as governor. We know we have a very, very competitive Republican primary, and that's going to be, I think, one of the biggest targets for the Republican Governors Association to try to pick up that governor's race. But I think it'll have a big impact on Senator Marshall's reelection as well. This is a state that is currently just an R+8. And he's got to raise money. There's sort of not a lot of expensive media markets. If you look at Kansas, you've got this huge congressional district. They call it the Big One. It's the first congressional district that's currently represented by Tracy Mann. And I think Roger Marshall actually represented it before him. And Jerry Moran, Kansas's other senator, represented it before him. And so it's kind of like where the senators come from in Kansas is this big agricultural district that represents the entire western part of the state all the way into like the central eastern part. So we're going to be watching that one pretty closely, and I feel very confident that Roger Marshall will win re-election, but the question is, how much can he win by?
Let's go south. Alabama, normally also a Republican bastion, a little bit of an anomaly a few years ago, gave us a Democrat for a while. Where do things stand in Alabama head into 2026?
I feel great about this state. It's a big red state now, and we've got Coach Tommy Tuberville running for governor, not running for United States Senate. And so that's created this open Republican primary. You've got their Attorney General, Steve Marshall, taking on Congressman Barry Moore, and there's a handful of other candidates that are sort of in the race as well, a guy named Jared Hudson, who I think was a Navy SEAL. And then there's another candidate named Morgan Murphy that's also running. Club for Growth in the past has supported Barry Moore in his congressional races. We're watching that race very closely. One interesting fact about Barry Moore is he was the first elected politician to endorse President Trump in 2015. And it's a funny story where he basically volunteered to speak first at this rally, and while he was speaking first, he went ahead and made that endorsement, and then other politicians in Alabama endorsed a few minutes later. But it's something that I think President Trump remembers, because Barry Moore had the foresight to understand what America First and MAGA represented in this Trump candidacy in 2015.
A state where we are going to see a hotly contested general election, probably going to be one of the most expensive in the country, North Carolina. An open seat there and clashes ahead, right?
That's right. Tom Tillis announced he was retiring. We've got the Democrat is going to be Roy Cooper, former governor, somebody that's been elected statewide and was fairly popular as governor. And he's running against Michael Whatley, the former Republican National Committee chairman. And so Whatley's never been elected to public office, but he's been involved at the highest levels of government, raising money nationally. He was a former chief of staff to Elizabeth Dole and is just a tremendous political operator. But he's got to get his name ID up there so people can understand who he is, what he stands for, and how he's going to fight for the America First agenda in North Carolina and in the United States Senate in Washington. We are watching that race very closely. I think that the primaries are cleared and Whatley's going to be the guy. How that shakes out for November. I bet you this is going to be the most expensive Senate race in 2026. If not, it's going to be in Georgia.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, a bit about the club.
So we're this economic conservative organization united in the idea of liberty and freedom and free markets. If you want to learn more about us, visit clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
From disastrous COVID-19 policies to inflation-inducing stimulus packages, the 2020s have already seen its share of economic missteps. We learn more now from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Well, we've made it through the first half of the 2020s. Can you believe it? And if the past half decade has taught us anything in politics, I think it's probably this. Maybe you should listen to what the economists have to say before making any big decisions. Hi, folks. It's Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Happy New Year to you and your family. And yes, we rang in the new year already this week. And I know. I was technically wrong a moment ago when I said we made it through the first half of the 2020s. The decade was actually half over a full year ago at the start of 2025. But the end of 2025, I don't know. Maybe you agree with me. Maybe you don't. It just sort of feels like the midpoint. It feels like the turning point as we head into 2026 and we head into, oh boy, deep breath here, the late 2020s. That's where we are. It's a good time to take stock of where we've been, good time to take a quick look back at some of the big stories that have defined the decade so far. Three of them stand out to me, three in particular, and I choose to highlight these three because of a common theme, which I already mentioned. This decade has been defined by politicians telling the economists to get lost, kind of kicking them out of the room, metaphorically, if not literally, and then facing unfortunate consequences for the decisions that were made without listening to what the economists had to say. The first one of those big stories starts all the way back in the spring of 2020. Yes, the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2020, public health officials found themselves suddenly setting emergency policy for much of the country. And the economists were either dismissed or ignored or unheard of from as the lockdowns and other COVID responses took effect. And all of that, I think you would agree with me, was a big failure. Now, economists know that every policy has costs, and they know that better than most other people involved in the policymaking process. Thomas Sowell once famously said, "There are no solutions, only trade-offs." Lockdowns were, of course, not a solution, and too late we became aware of all the trade-offs, the social trade-offs, the educational trade-offs, and yes, of course, the economic trade-offs. When you force businesses to close, for example, that has all sorts of spillover effects. We don't want to relive all that. We don't have time to relive all that here, so we'll skip ahead, but I think it's pretty obvious in retrospect that the economists needed to be at least in the room with the public health officials who were making the decision. And I think one of the big lessons of the COVID pandemic was that when you just give that branch, one particular branch of the policymaking apparatus, all of the power, you're going to end up with trade-offs that you don't necessarily like. Coming out of the pandemic, then, is the second story that I want to highlight here. Joe Biden was now the president, and in the first year of his presidency, he and his advisors made a critical mistake. Once again, they failed to listen to the economists. Joe Biden's administration dedicated its first weeks in office to spending more money on pandemic relief and shrugged off warnings that the economy may overheat as a result. That's how Bloomberg summarized things in a piece that was published in February 2021. The Biden administration was making a big bet on what Bloomberg called run-it-hot economics. That included the delivery of another round of stimulus checks as part of a $1.9 trillion relief bill. But there were plenty of economists who said that was a mistake, including Larry Summers, a veteran of the Obama administration, certainly not a conservative by any means. He warned that passing another stimulus bill in the spring of 2021 would set off inflationary pressures of a kind we have not seen in a generation. And he didn't just say that to some of his friends. He said that in the pages of the Washington Post. Other top economists, including a former chairman at the International Monetary Fund, offered similar warnings, but the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress did not listen. And then what happened? We saw inflation of a kind that we hadn't seen in a generation. By June 2022, annual inflation had peaked at more than 9%. And here we are at the start of 2026, and inflation has still not returned to that annual 2% rate that the Federal Reserve maintains as its target. Inflation, in many ways, I think, has actually eclipsed the pandemic as kind of the biggest story, at least in economic and in fiscal policy, during the 2020s. And now you've got the Trump administration once again, and I fear that they are in some ways repeating that same mistake of ignoring the economists. When Trump launched his trade war with China and Canada and Mexico in February, the economists were basically told to take a hike once again. That message was repeated in April when the White House announced its Liberation Day tariffs. In fact, Vice President J.D. Vance took to Twitter to declare that the economists don't actually understand tariffs. But the result of all of this has so far been pretty much exactly what the economists were predicting. It's been a huge tax increase on American businesses, which has caused a whole bunch of negative consequences, slowdowns in hiring, slowdown in investment, things like that. The Tax Foundation says this is the single largest tax increase in more than 30 years. And of course, I remind you, it was all without congressional authorization. The Trump administration promised that tariffs would close the trade deficit and boost American manufacturing, but actually neither of those things has happened so far. American manufacturing ended 2025 in a recession, and the trade deficit continues to grow. And indeed, that makes sense. If you make things more expensive to import, then it's going to be more expensive to manufacture things, because more than half of all imports to the United States are raw materials and intermediate goods necessary for manufacturing. We'll still have to see in 2026 and beyond how the rest of that story plays out, but so far it seems like that mistake, while not as great of an error as the two previous ones made during the pandemic and just afterwards, it's the same kind of error. It's the same mistake, telling the economists that they don't know what they're talking about and going ahead with policy that doesn't take into account the costs and consequences, the economic costs and consequences, I should say. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Happy New Year to you. We'll hope for better in 2026 on all fronts, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Taxpayers are the big winners in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and states across the country that are lowering taxes are experiencing population growth. We get details now from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal Commentary.
The year 2025 will be remembered as another chapter in America's long-running argument over the economy, one in which the evidence continues to point in a familiar direction. In short, freedom works. At the federal level, lawmakers made permanent the lower tax rates first signed into law by President Donald Trump in 2017. Which had been scheduled to expire at the end of 2025. The new 2025 Trump tax cuts retained provisions designed to reduce the tax penalty on work, savings, and investment. The result is not mysterious. Hardworking Americans will now keep more of what they earn, and fewer economic decisions will be distorted by the tax code. More success continues to occur at the state level. This year, 11 states, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Utah, cut personal income tax rates. These were broad-based reductions that applied to any hardworking individual earning a living or investing in those states, as well as nearly all small businesses on Main Street. Such policies leave individuals with more disposable income, which can be spent, saved, or invested without government officials needing to decide in advance who deserves relief. States that reduce taxes on work also make themselves more attractive places to live and do business. Americans are not a captive tax base. Over the past 15 years, for instance, more than 4 million people on net have moved to Florida and Texas alone. These are two of the states in the country, of course, with no personal income tax at all. Over the same period of time, New York and California, which imposed some of the nation's highest marginal tax rates, lost roughly 4.7 million residents to the other states. These outcomes are not surprising. They reflect predictable responses to incentives. It is therefore unsurprising that states such as Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Kentucky are charting paths toward eliminating their income taxes altogether. Missouri took a partial step this year by eliminating taxes on capital gains, and plans to fully eliminate the state's personal income tax are underway in Jefferson City as we speak. Nearly two decades of evidence from our ALEC Rich States, Poor States report point to the same conclusion. States that want growth and competitiveness would do well to resemble Texas and Florida and avoid the mistakes of New York and California. Kansas offers a useful reminder of how past political narratives can sometimes obscure economic reality. More than a decade ago, tax cuts there were blamed for subsequent budget deficits, even though those deficits were stemming from spending rather than the tax relief itself. That version of events, though, hardened into conventional wisdom, discouraging reform elsewhere. Yet over the years, many states have cut taxes while balancing their budgets successfully. And in 2025, Kansas embraced a flat income tax while cutting tax rates. And in the process, lawmakers there rewrote the story that once incorrectly defined their state for years. Kansas was not alone in 2025. Ohio policymakers enacted legislation to implement a 2.75% flat tax beginning on January 1st. With these additions, now eight states have shifted from progressive income taxes to flat taxes in the past 5 years. The appeal is not simply ideological, but practical. Flat taxes reduce penalties on additional work, simplify compliance, and make budgeting more practical. While some states enacted policies that will increase tax burdens and inevitably the cost of living, resistance is emerging. In Oregon, a newly appointed tax increase had been put on hold pending a voter referendum next year. If voters reject it, the tax will be eliminated entirely in the backyard of modern-day progressive ideology. The broader pattern is clear. Tax relief continues to be a winning issue. Congress and President Trump wisely made the 2017 federal tax relief permanent. 11 states cut personal income tax rates, and others continued reductions already in law, and even more advanced flat taxes or planned for the elimination of income taxes altogether. Iowa and Louisiana completed their first full year under flat tax systems, while Kansas and Ohio followed their lead. And when you combine the historic efforts at the state and federal levels, an overwhelming majority of Americans will now see greater affordability directly due to these lower tax burdens. And that is something which we can all be thankful for this year. For more information, you can go to ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KION-AM and FM in Salinas, California, along with WGAO-FM in Franklin, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.